There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 690. So let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. I have a thing.
Ooh.
My friend Barry McLaughlin has a Kickstarter that has about 2 days left, and they're trying to Kickstarter this thing called Game Night in a Can. So it's essentially a can full of stuff that will create an instant game night. Like,
well, then you better let it out.
Yeah. You better let it out. They're trying to raise $20,000, and right now they're at $18,700.
So close.
$1,300 away for the last 2 days to realize their nerdy game night in a can.
Oh, you guys should do that.
And you should go do that right now. Just go to Kickstarter and type in game night in a can. Ooh. It's the game night in a can.
That sounds like a good time.
What you got, Kyle?
I got a graphic novel that I'm real stoked about. An artist from Portland named Ibrahim Mustafa is the artist who did a comic called High Crimes. It was a digital comic that Dark Horse is putting out. It comes out July 8th and is about a disgraced Olympic snowboarder who gets into grave robbing. That's my new favorite logline for anything.
That's fantastic.
How cool does that sound? So I'm totally going to go pick this up. I've been really excited about it ever since I read it. It sounds super cool.
And also potential career options.
Yeah. Both things that I've aspired to at different points in life.
Katie?
Yeah. I want to plug this really cool coffee company called Grounds and Hounds. And every pound of coffee they sell,
made with dog.
It saves a dog, not made with dog. The opposite.
That's always weird. I took a sip from this product and I was like, it needs more dog.
Not dog enough. But yeah, it's really cool. And they work with a bunch of different charities. And if you go to groundsandhoundscoffee.com, you can check it out. And the coffee's really good, too. So
yeah.
Fantastic.
It's mellow and not rough. I'm not proud
God.
Of that.
I'm
you really son of a bitch. You grave robbing son of a bitch.
If I had a nickel for every time I've been called that.
This episode is Chris Pratt and Colin Trevorrow. Colin directed Jurassic World, which is...
He did a pretty good job with that.
Now,
holy fuck, that movie's good.
I mean, it just made $500 million in a weekend.
It's everything, like, 11-year-old me is just like, finally, the movie I've always wanted.
My favorite thing about the movie, and this isn't giving away too much, is that it very cleverly ties in the Jurassic Park
brilliantly.
Of it all in a way that makes sense. Like, I love that it's a consistent, and I hadn't seen the movie when these guys came on, and so it they cleverly tie in a way that makes it like, oh, this is all part of the same universe. It's not a redo. It makes sense in the timeline of when Jurassic
Park
came out.
Which is crazy because so rarely do sequels work the timeline to their advantage. This one does such a great job.
Yeah.
My two favorite things. One, the production design on this movie is amazing. It looks like a real theme park. As a theme park
nerd, the timeline and work the chef.
It's insane.
It does look like a theme park.
Fun fact, there's a scene where people are running away. Somebody grabs a margarita from the Margaritaville that's there. It's Jimmy Buffett.
Jimmy Buffett sang at the after party at the
premiere.
Did
he really?
They set up a Margaritaville and Jimmy Buffett sang.
That was my favorite thing. Was just like, I think it's Jimmy Buffett running by.
So I do. There was one moment in the podcast that I want to pre apologize for, because I was talking to Chris Pratt about, like, one of the things I think is so great about him is that he's
the best.
He's the best, and he's really funny, and he's a leading man that I can get behind because he feels
I'd love to get behind him.
All right. He feels like Don't try to rob his grave. And but he's a very human. And so I said, you know, what I was saying was, you know, guys like Joss Whedon and James Gunn and Sam Raimi have managed to take that like the action star and humanize
that. We can
and
add
course,
one more person.
Colin
to that,
Trevorrow was sitting right there, and then
he was like, "Hey, bro."
Yeah, and then Matt's like, "Why didn't you include Colin in that?" And I go, "Because in my head, I was just thinking of superhero movies. I was just thinking of Spider-Man. I was just thinking of Guardians, and I was just thinking of Avengers. Like, I wasn't thinking
just
of
your default brain.
That was my default brain. I was like, I meant for superhero action movies." But I did not articulate that
he,
at the time.
He borders on being a superhero in this. Oh, my God.
He kind of is.
I loved Safety Not Guaranteed. Like, Colin is quickly becoming one of my favorite directors.
Colin directed Safety Not Guaranteed as well. So these guys were fantastic. Jurassic World is out now. I assume you've seen it because of how much money it made. But if not, go see it again. It's probably going to be around in theaters for a little while. So see it at every turn.
Upwards of 3 weeks.
Yeah. And again, Colin, super cool. Pratt, fucking rad. Like, it was. And I saw Colin at the premiere afterwards. And he came, and this guy was at his movie premiere, and he took the time to come over and say hi and thanks for having us on today.
Good dude.
I'm totally, you have my heart, Colin. May I please have a
and
back.
My money.
And now here we go with the Nerds Podcast number 690 with Chris Pratt and Colin Trevorrow.
Katie, roll the thing. Here it comes, the thing. Where and Janet Varney says, "Welcome to the hangar."
Good note.
I'm a liar, and I'm not stopping.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Dear future,
are you Marty McFly?
Joe Flaherty. Oh, I completely forgot about that storyline. I completely forgot about that.
How could you forget about that? That's the craziest part of that movie.
Because I put a lot of part two out of my head.
What is wrong of you?
Part two?
No. Because they had to do so much retcon to make one make sense to bridge to three. That the whole movie, like, two was basically just like, it might as well have just been someone coming out and going, so here's what happens, and here's how this all makes sense, and
it.
Here's why this is another timeline.
I like exposition, science bullshit, technobabble, as they call it in Star Trek.
Yeah, but even as a kid, like, when they go up to Biff's pleasure palace,
yeah.
And then and it's like they're right
in 1985
in the alternate 1985, and the things are playing, and they're like, and that's when Biff Tannen made his fort. It was just like every piece of this movie is exposition to, just to bridge one and three. It drove me crazy. I liked three. I thought three was really fun, but three's
fun. It's, I don't think it's great.
Two drove
I think
me crazy.
Better than three.
Colin, where do you weigh in on the
effect? Can't do it. Two. I can't do it.
Yeah, two. Right.
Yeah.
Can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you feel that way?
Well, I'll tell you. I think
one is the, you know, of the like four great stories of the modern age,
yeah.
Which I consider to be, you know, a kid helps an alien find his way home.
Yep.
Mac and me.
Right.
I think he's
going to
be
his
boss on this.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
No, gotcha. They're often connected. You know, Nazis
try
to harness the power of God. Kid tries to make sure his parents fall in love so he can exist. I mean, there is nothing in part two that begins to approach that level of emotional stakes. That part one has, and it is a little bit more of a, it's like a time travel math movie,
it's not a hard movie.
No, it doesn't get you here.
It gets you here.
It gets you here. Not here.
Oh my God.
And here we are in 2015.
Yeah.
Isn't that strange?
And we have hoverboards.
We got
and
all the stuff.
We can hydrate a pizza.
Everything
and,
we were promised.
You know, all of our fax machines are
hydrate
in the
level four.
Everything. They really, it's funny to see where they put their stock. I mean, because you can watch Star Trek and go, you know, give or take, they weren't too far off with some of, you know, they didn't see the micro revolution.
With
how
many hundreds of years.
Welcome. You're not disrupting anything. No. You can come lumbering in.
Last interview.
Last one ever.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah. Well,
wow. Right here. So we can get a little weird.
Blow it out?
Mm-hmm.
What you're walking into is
this happening?
What you're walking into is.
I didn't know we were on, then suddenly.
Oh, yeah,
we were
it's
on.
Already started.
Okay.
Huh? I want tequila, I told you.
What else do you want?
Oh, nothing.
Do you want some water?
No.
Do you want some water in a shot glass? Do you want to? And we'll give you a lime, and then you can.
I started drinking already, so now I'm on the drinking train. This is our last interview, right?
Yep.
No, you have to
do Kimmel. Oh no, I have to do Kimmel.
God damn it! Don't do it.
That's fine.
Are you doing that tonight? No.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
You know, this isn't really an interrogation. This is just more of a loose conversation. So
I know. I know all about this, brother. I didn't know. I know everything.
What?
Well, Chris, what you walked into was a discussion of Back to the Future 2.
Yes. Yeah. Matt seems to like Back to the Future 2. Colin and I feel that that doesn't have enough heart and it's too expositional. And we were starting to talk about how way far off they missed 2015. That they put a lot of stock in fax machines and hydration.
Max Spielberg's
food.
Not even a director.
He's not even a
Jaws director. 18 or whatever.
Yeah,
the fuck
there's
it was.
There's no hologram that comes spewing out of a movie theater and jackets and stuff.
No.
Right. And there's no almanac.
There's no sports almanac.
Right. We have a version of the sports almanac, but not something that you could actually transport back in time.
No.
You know, unless you did like
unless you printed
a very thought out version of it and set up a game plan. Single book.
You'd have to bring the internet.
You'd have to bring the internet, and of course, the internet wouldn't. You can't bring the internet.
No. I have a very political reason why I actually do love Back to the Future 2. It was very prescient, forward-thinking plotline, which is that there was a time, I think, where a single, you know, he said that red letter date where time split across and we had a time tangent. And I feel like I always considered the Bush administration to be where Biff Tannen went into the future and married your mom and turned your town into a mall. There was one moment.
Laura Bush was like, you're the one that told me to get these things, George.
Yeah.
The thing I don't understand about the end of Back to the Future is Doc Brown shows up. His life is perfect now, although somehow the entire family is sharing one car. But they Doc Brown shows up and he's like, quick, we have to get back.
Where?
We have to get back to the future. We don't have time. I was like, but you have all the time in the world. Right. Literally, there's no reason to rush.
Right. You could have dinner.
To get to your time machine. Yeah. Like, you could go to Disneyland.
Maybe Doc's the kind of guy that, like, if he doesn't do it right now, he's going to never
he's
get
gonna
to
forget.
It.
He's
like, whatever.
Doc, where were we supposed to?
I don't remember.
I'm old now. Who put all this poop in my underwear?
That's true. I never, of all the holes, that was never one that I realized. Yeah. You.
Well, I don't want to dismantle all of the things that
kind of sounds like you do.
That's kind of what's happening.
Systematically.
Yeah. No, but you're right. What's the rush?
Yeah.
What's the rush to get back? Marty. Oh, what? You know why? Because doesn't someone then chase him into that moment?
No. He just says something's got to be done about your kids.
Right. He doesn't know that Biff is going to stop polishing the car and do something, which he doesn't do. He just watches them go away.
Biff
the beginning
see
of the second
them.
One. Remember the beginning of the second one.
Yeah, old
you see
Biff.
That Biff's looking and he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna do something."
Old Biff,
right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, his cane breaks off in the car, leaving a giant breadcrumb trail.
Exactly.
As to
you know who? I think it was Seth MacFarlane tweeted something pretty hilarious about Back to the Future. That was just another one of those things that I just kind of mind blown that I didn't consider it. But at the very end, where she goes, "Marty, or will we ever see you again?" And he's like, "Yeah, well, you'll see me tomorrow. We go to school together." Like, why would?
Like,
why would you?
I don't know. You're just assuming that I'm not going to be here anymore.
Just because I'm like, you know,
just because you were expelled after that rock and roll display, they would never. You can't. Strickland's not tolerant at all. But we're here to talk about other things.
Back to the Future 3.
Wow, starts off in the West. I'm actually surprised no one's been like, part four, guys. You know, I'm surprised that it hasn't been unearthed.
I'm deep on the inside defending that and stopping that from happening. I'm involved,
someone
like making
be.
Sure it doesn't
You're
happen.
Deflecting it like Tron.
I'm deep in the trenches.
You almost didn't sign to direct Jurassic World because you were busy.
No, I will do this.
Not on my watch, man.
I will do this as long as you promise it says contractually there will not be a back.
Don't touch it.
Four.
Don't touch it.
Is this cup of coffee for me?
I think so.
What?
Possibly.
Did you just bring that here?
Did.
So nice. That's awesome. So, guess what just happened?
What just happened?
You got coffee.
This is crazy. How did you know?
Matt's a coffee psychic. What is that?
Triumph gave me...
They gave you the motorcycle?
I don't know if they gave it or my agent bought it from them. My agent had a big gift for me today, and it was...
That's fucking awesome.
My motorcycle from the movie.
Your life is a playground now.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Your life is a fucking playground.
Yep.
Yeah, that's funny. I was just walking down La Brea staring at that motorcycle.
On the
poster.
Uh-huh.
I was like,
one of a kind. Custom built for this movie. I'm the only one on the planet who has this motorcycle.
That's incredible.
Yep.
You're at Nick Cage level now.
Dude.
They gave him the Mustang from Gone in 60 Seconds.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Dude.
They made like three.
Him and Bruckheimer got one.
Whoa.
I got a really nice food basket.
Did you? and the note said, a Triumph.
Some caramel corn.
A Triumph.
No, I don't know.
We got everybody.
It's a disparity between these two.
Yeah.
Little
I'm going to put it in my living room. Yeah. I'm not gonna drive it.
No, I mean.
I'm not good at riding on motorcycles.
Oh, you're not? I'm not a motorcycle guy.
No.
Is it? But
if I ever live out in the country where it's just long open roads and not like a old drivers everywhere.
Do you think you will move out to the country at some point? I mean, you're kind of getting to that place where you could just like, I'm just going to go disappear, and then when you want me, I'll appear and be in things.
Oh, I think I might be there. Yeah. Yeah. This is like the last. They'll be like, he went and did the Nerdist.
And then
didn't even show up to the premiere.
Yeah. I'll get blamed for that somehow. Yeah. Nerdist podcast scares Chris Pratt into obscurity. What happened?
That's really always been our goal. Yeah. That's what we're going to do.
Kimmel left with fruit basket that says Triumph.
Yeah.
Kimmel turns fruit basket into delightful viral video that gets 100 million views. But I know a lot of people lately.
Not to brag.
A lot of people don't appreciate you. No, I'm kidding. But a lot of people have been hitting you with the, you've gone through this transformation, and I'm sure it's tiring to talk about it over and over again. But as someone who went through something somewhat similar to that, I'm curious, what did it do to your identity? Like, what do you, when you see a different, I mean, there were points where I saw a different guy in the mirror, and it kind of weirded me out at first.
I just recently saw the Parks and Rec season 7 rap video came out. It's like a 30-minute long gag reel from the season 7 of Parks and Rec, and part of it was they show our audition tapes on the gag reel, right? And so I was watching it, and I looked at that guy, and I was like, I've been aging backwards for 7 years. Like, and I think it's the result. It is obviously the result of like good food and diet and exercise and all of that stuff, which was, you know, I have had a couple of those moments where I just look and I see, but I don't know. I'm taking it back. Like, I see pictures of when I was bigger and I didn't see it happen overnight or anything, but I'll look at those pictures and I'll think, whoa, I was really big. Like, I was just, and I didn't think much of it in the moment. I don't know. Yeah, I've had a bit of a...
Well, I appreciate something that you wrote. I don't know if you said this in an interview or you wrote it, but it was essentially the idea that it's not that you weren't saying, you know, you shouldn't judge, your identity shouldn't be attached to whatever your size is. That's not the important thing. I just was making unhealthy choices, and I started making healthier choices and feeling better about myself. And that's really ultimately what it was, that you should feel good, you know, wherever you are, as long as you're making good, healthy choices.
Well, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, you know, you don't have to feel bad if you're not in good shape. Like, there are positives and negatives to both lifestyles. And when I was big and eating and drinking anything I wanted, there was there were amazing moments that I don't get to have now that I really enjoyed at the time. And I've also really enjoyed this as well. You know, there are moments here that I get a little bummed out, and there were moments then that I got a little bummed out. I think it's all. it's all the same. There's a huge drive, you know, a huge desire for people, probably because of the magazines that now I'm on the cover of, that I, you know, things like that, that like, man, I wish I looked like that. And that's like a, it drives a market, and it's like a, it's a weird thing. But I, you know, I say don't get caught too much. Don't, I'm not going to, I don't want to sit here and criticize it. I'd rather just take advantage of it.
Right, right.
Know, and get that ranch and get, and take my Triumph out into the middle of nowhere somehow. That's all this is leading towards. But, you know, you can make yourself feel better, and you can, if some, you like, sound body, sound mind. I think like your spirit, your mentality, it's all really tied into, you know, the vehicle that you're given. You know, you, that's, you aren't your body, or you aren't your image, but that's what you have to drive around on this planet as long as you can keep it running. So, you sure. know, you could take it out and polish it and take it out and, you know, take good care of it. And it's more fun to drive.
Yeah. And also I just found that that was not really the goal, but it was sort of a byproduct of just, oh, I'm going to exercise because the older I get, if I don't, I'm just going to essentially start to, you know, keel over and freeze up because yeah. I'm in front of a computer all the time, and I'll end up being a, you know, I'll just be end up being a turgid little alien creature if I don't try to exercise and feel better with myself. And the side, the byproduct of that was like, oh, I kind of look better too, and I feel better in general, and that's not terrible.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Do you feel imprisoned at all by the, just in the sense that, you know, you start out and you kind of, from what I understand about you, you're sort of like, well, I know I want to do stuff. I don't know how I'm exactly going to do that. And then things started to happen. Did it, now that you have achieved, I would imagine, pretty much everything you could have imagined, and there's certainly more coming, does it feel like you thought it would feel, or does it, or do you feel sort of like, oh, it feels like there's more, it's more responsibility than I imagined when I was picturing it?
Oh, it doesn't, I don't know. I'm not sure I feel anything.
At
ever,
all.
Ever.
I feel nothing.
I feel nothing, yeah. I feel dead inside.
Just feels 120 so from the horse between his
yeah,
legs now.
Yeah. Just boners. I just feel follow my boners.
All day. Long.
No, it does. It feels good. It's not quite what I would have expected. It's really, really hard to put words to it. You know, I think life's about perspective, and it's difficult to maintain perspective no matter where you are, and mm-hmm. it's no different for me now. I think like the simple things in life are still what please me, and sometimes still what piss me off, you know, and I feel like I'm just the same. Life has changed a lot around me, but I don't know, I haven't changed that much, and I think people's perception of me has changed, but that's all their perspective, and I'm probably seem bigger. I seem like a big star, but that's just because I'm closer to Earth. You know, like the sun seems like the biggest star in the sky, but it's not. It just happens to be the one that's closest to us. And right now, I'm very close to you because I'm on a fucking press tour. And you know, every 5 minutes I go and talk to somebody else or tweet something. I'm trying to promote this movie, but eventually I'll fade way off and I'll just be another little speck in the sky. And but that, you know, I don't feel any different. It's all how big I am in the eyes of the people around me, or just like relative to how close I am to them in that moment. You know, for me, nothing has really changed about me. My exterior has changed a little bit. I've lost anonymity a little bit. When I go out, there's more people that stop me in the street. Airports have become a different game, and there are sometimes paparazzi outside of my house. But the things that have changed the most for me are just normal changes that any man would go through who's married, has a 2.5 or 3 year old kid. You know, I don't sleep in as much as I used to. I don't drink as much as I used to. I'm more present and I stress out about shit that I never did before. I never took my life seriously before, but now I have things that are very, I have to take seriously in my life. It's just the normal stuff that's changed. All the other stuff connected to the fame and to this sort of interesting and exciting chapter in my career right now doesn't feel that different. There's nothing that you can't really feel anything.
Well, I think it's also better for that to happen not when you're 22, but yeah. as you get into your 30s or older, you can kind of, because you do have the perspective and yeah. you do, no matter what happens, and you know, you'll go to the premiere tonight and people will be, you know, flipping their shit, and it'll be like, whoa, and then you'll get home and like, oh, my son pooped on the floor. Like, you still have that, I think, it seems like you might still have that to tether you to
yeah.
and to stuff that actually, you know, like matters the most.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Their roots. I put my roots down, you know, and they're with my family and in my house, and that's. I can't imagine. It's got to. I know it's daunting for people who are younger to deal with fame in like big doses. Because yeah. Yeah, good thing, man. It's a good thing I wasn't famous when I was young, because I was just doing shit that would have really, really ruined people's perception of me. I was screwing up, as you should when you're a kid, and you should be able to do that in a vacuum, you know? Yeah. Like, there's no...
Not under a microscope.
Nobody's 20 should be on the record.
Yeah,
No.
Not right? At all. Think about it.
Especially now. I mean, like, there wasn't social media when I was growing up, and so there was some degree of fuck-uppery that you could, I think, that, you know, like Brat Pack kids could get away with. But now it just seems, you know, everything is just so broadcast all the time.
I have a good friend who was a journalist who was older than me, who gave me great advice when I was in my 20s, and he said very clearly, look, like between now and 28, like you can fuck up like 5 times, and you'll still recover, and you'll be fine. And I was talking to our young star, to Nick Robinson, the other day, who's kind of dealing with some of this stuff of, like, he's, you know, impending fame, and I wanted to, you know, be the wise old man and give him that same, you know, advice. And I was like, well, no, you can't really fuck up 5 times, like maybe like twice now, maybe once, but like right. Actually don't fuck up, stop,
don't fuck up.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's almost
things have changed.
Yeah, the strive to be perfect and the strive for perfection, which was, you know, even the fact that you would have the presence of mind to write a pre-apology about your press tour was fucking genius. I mean, yeah. So and also genius from not just from a comedy standpoint, but also from, you totally just gave yourself a pass. Like, people are going to be like, this is the thing he was talking about. He told us this would happen. It's totally cool.
There he goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant move.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. That's I was happy with that. I put that out without running it by any of my representatives or anything like that. And then I stood back and said,
poor Allison.
We're winking at Allison, my publicist, who's in the room right now.
You were okay with it, right?
But I think what's important for people to see is that it's very humanizing, you know, you're a person. And I think people forget that because they're used to seeing people, you know, two-dimensionally, basically. Oh, that person represents all those things. And then when something isn't congruent with the way that that person behaves, they go, what happened?
You're just right. Yeah.
So it's important, I think, to let people know, like, I'm a guy and I just do a job and I'm not, you know.
Right, but that was all very mindful management of what's happening. Like, I didn't just, like, accidentally stumble and write that apology. This was, like, a very well thought out maneuver in dealing with this. Because, like, if you look at, and I probably shouldn't give that away. In fact, I should probably pretend like I just, you know, tweeted that as a joke and it was no big deal. But the truth is, like, you know, back in the silent film era, all you had to do was look right on camera, and then all of a sudden the talkies came and people had to match your voice with your face. And some people didn't make it through that. Some actors didn't make it through that. They're just like, what? That guy has an accent or you know, or their voice is higher than I thought. And then, you know, so only a certain amount of people made it through that filter. And now all of a sudden, if you sounded right and you looked right, you'd be a huge star. And it didn't matter who you were. You could be a complete asshole. You could fucking go and be just a real piece of shit and abuse drugs and, you know, beat women or whatever, you know, like your private life wasn't part of it. It was just what you looked like and what you sounded like and the characters that you played. That's what people knew. They knew the character that you played and they judged who you were based on the character that you played. Now this day and age, there's like a new third thing that's come to the forefront, which is, who are you? What's your personality like? Are you a decent person? How are you in an interview? Do you squirm? How much will you give up of yourself? You know, and I think that's like the new transition that people have had to make. And you see actors out there who have bad reputations, who are assholes, who treat the people around them poorly, who don't get along with their fellow castmates, and who, you know, shit on the crew. And those guys, they don't work anymore. Like, they just don't get work anymore.
Oh yeah, yeah. And rightfully so. Yeah, I mean,
rightfully
but
so.
Those people, you know,
for
those
a while it did better.
But those types of personality, those personality types, though, that they can sustain that for a minute or two. But the second people don't have to deal with their shit anymore, like the second their movies aren't number one anymore, they're not on a hit show, then,
right.
Then it's basically all the rats abandon the ship.
Buckle right. up, Depp.
Yeah, man. Someone got to take that guy down a notch. Yeah.
Well, the likelihood is if your movies aren't performing, they'll all abandon ship anyways, whether you're really nice or not.
You're
but
really
at least
nice,
you
but,
leave with yeah. some part of your humanity intact if you're a nicer
person.
You know,
but I don't know, though, because I really do believe, you know, there are people that you see in the business who work very consistently and – you know, you kind of go, oh, wow, it's interesting. Like, they've maybe had show after show fail or the movies aren't connecting, but they continue to work. And I just attribute that to, you know, it's important for people to work around people that they like and they want them to win and they want to give them a shot. And, you know, and then the other side, it's so fascinating to me because it's so silly that we get to do this stuff. It's so silly that we get to do this, that for someone to get in their own way and sabotage that, it's like, oh, well – maybe you should just socially Darwin your way out of this because you don't belong in this type of a situation to work with other people.
That's a good kind of Darwinism. That's a good kind of survival of the fittest, being a nice, good person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like if we're going to have a standard, because I find the same thing. I mean, our cast doesn't make any sense. And our cast is because all of those are really good, great actors, but also good people to work with. You know, Bryce Dallas Howard is a good person. She hadn't been in a movie in 4 years. She had two kids. You know, she was not necessarily like on the forefront of the actors that were killing it at the moment. But everyone knows that she is a great person, like her father and like people who surround her, Chris Pratt, great person. And also I think, you know, what's interesting about Pratt is you know, this transformation that you guys were talking about, like, you know, what motivated that had to have come from a different place. Because I think if you look at all of us, if we were like sitting on the couch and we were like almost 300 pounds and Anna Faris already loved us, like, I'm not sure if we would have the motivation to do what he did. But he dug deep and found it anyway for reasons beyond that.
I mean, that really
it's always impressed me.
That really is kind of that's kind of the sitcom construct that every American wants. Like, you know, I'll let myself go, but the little lady loves me anyway for who I am. And that, like, that's a dream. That's a sort of a dream scenario. In a
found
sort of,
it. It's true. Found it's the true. Motivation.
Yeah.
She wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah. What's her perspective on, I mean, like, I mean, she loves you either way, but what does she have? Does she have a particular perspective on?
I think, like, she's very smart, and I think that she probably assumes, here's my take, my guess. My guess is she really likes it, but she's not going to come out and say it because she sees how fast I can get fat.
Sure.
And if I get fat again, she knows that I'll be like, you went on record saying you like me skinnier, you know? So she's always been like, I love him both ways. And I love my husband. And, oh, it was fun when he was fat. I could feed him and all of these things. So when she's just kind of playing it cool so that when I do inevitably become fat again, she'll be like, see, honey, I told you I always liked you. See, she's playing.
I can go back. I can dance between the I can dance between the towns.
Yeah.
Fine. But, right back and
forth. Yeah. But I have a feeling that she likes it. I have a feeling that she really likes it. It's nice.
Well, when I was young and drinking a lot, and, you know, I mean, I was only probably like 40 pounds heavier, but you could see it in my, I mean, there's still pictures of it online that make me cringe, but I dated a girl who was really funny, and she used to go, hey, I just want to remind you, you were really fucking fat. And I'm like, I know. Like, as a joke, like she would say, yeah, she would make fat jokes about old me.
Oh,
which I thought was really fun. By the way, I named that person. I gave that person a separate name. Like, he has a separate name.
Oh, is that
–
what's his name?
Peter Hardwick.
Yeah.
When people were like, oh, were you in this movie or were you in the show? I'm like, no, that was Peter. Yeah, that was Peter. He was really drunk. He was really drunk when he went to that. When you're with Jurassic Park, with this kind of a property, are you nervous at all? I mean, is it – obviously you must have been inspired because the original still completely holds up. Is there – and we're talking about Back to the Future and you know, making another and making more Back to the Futures. And so what in your brain goes, no, I have a story that I can tell about this that I think I'm ready to tell, and my level of experience is enough that I can, that people will accept it. And I feel like it's important to tell.
Well, I mean, you know, as far as it was, I do get that question. I think people are very, very interested in like my anxiety levels on this because they imagine were you handpicked by Steven Spielberg to carry on his legacy? Like, yeah, I'm a human, and there were many moments where I would have to stare myself in the mirror and be like, "Don't fuck this up, man. Do not fuck this up."
Were there a bunch of directors in a living room, and Steven Spielberg handed you a rose?
Yeah, it has that. It's like, I have to like clarify. I didn't win a contest. I didn't like write in for this.
Were you there for the right reason,
dear Mr. Spielberg? No, it wasn't that. I know he gave me a call and I came in and we had the conversation about this movie. But you know, I never approached it with any lack of respect, but I did approach it kind of skeptical and probably with the same skepticism that you would approach it with if someone said, you know, remake Back to the Future. Fuck you, remake Back to the Future. Right. I will not do that. And so make a sequel to Jurassic Park. Okay, well, why? That was the first question. Why is Jurassic Park 4? Let us answer this question together. And so we sat and we had to like to dig into it and talk about, you know, what are some new themes that you know, science fiction, you know, holds a mirror up to our society, and Jurassic Park did that. So what can we talk about in this movie that is new, that isn't just, you know, the hubris of man and don't mess with science and chaos theory, and what we found, and this was all kind of in this first meeting, was inherent in his ideas that, like, you know, why were we making Jurassic Park 4 so a giant corporation could make a shit ton of money, and so why do we make a movie about that? Right. Like, you know, why do we make a movie about how, you know, we will repeat our mistakes if there's money on the table? And so, yeah, they're going to reopen Jurassic World, and they're going to bring 20,000 people to an island, and think the fences are going to work again. All of this is, you know, is based on that very corporate hunger for profit at all costs, and how that will steamroll over people and leave bodies in its wake time and again. And that was enough for me to feel like, okay, well, I can make a movie about that.
Yeah. And by the way, if there were dinosaurs, people would keep going back and trying to figure out a way to monetize that in some way.
Always. They'll just keep trying.
But you, because people, I'm sure everyone's hitting you with the Indiana Jones question, and from what I've read, you're like, I don't know, I feel weird about it. I don't know if I'm like, is it, do you, when you look at other things, because I would imagine you're pretty much getting to a point where people are like, what do you want to do? And then you can kind of go, well, I'll do that. And
I actually got a call today from my brother.
Yep.
And he said it'd be cool if I did it. So I have my brother's permission. So yeah. That's the first of many steps. None of the other steps. He's the only one to call.
My brother tweeted that. But you know what, though? That is important, actually. I mean, even though you could,
yeah,
I mean, like,
I was going to say that actually has, that's probably like 40% of it.
It,
yeah,
is.
Like that,
it is.
You know?
Because you still have to face your family and your friends, yeah. You know? And you don't, yeah, want them to be like, hey, oh, it was very brave of you, you know? Yeah. Like,
yeah. Yeah. It'd be hilarious to me if they just were like, okay, we're just going to continue the story. You're Shia LaBeouf's dad.
Yeah. God damn it. And then he's just screaming. They've just locked him in a tomb. And he's just screaming the whole time. But, I mean, when you have what I would assume to be, you know, a lot of choices, how do you know which is the right one?
Well, you don't, but for me, I have a great, you know, no one does this stuff alone, and so like I have a great team of, and it sounds cliche, and it sounds like a douchey Hollywood thing to my team, talk about my team, but I actually do. I have people whose job it is to guide me and help me make decisions, and the movies that I've done, and also many movies that I've decided not to do have that those decisions were the result of careful collaboration with people that I really trust and who I employ to help me make these decisions, you know. And so I won't get into them because if they end up making those movies, I don't want to like say disparaging words,
sure,
about some of them, but I've gotten offers that were financially the best offers I've ever seen. Jobs that I never would have fucking ever believed somebody would ever offer me that much money to do something. And it's a testament to my agents who are and my manager who is paid on commission, you know, and gets the bigger the paycheck is, the more they get paid. And they've been careful. They've been very, very careful. And they treat this very, you know, they're very precious about the things that I say yes to. And thank God, because if it was me, I'd already have like five movies in the can or in and out of the theaters that that were I'd be a part of that I that were terrible, you know, like
Forrest Gump 2.
Yeah. Well, no, movies, some movies that are out already that I said it's a crazy lesson that it's really you're very fortunate to ever be able to utilize this advice, but it's more powerful what you say no to
sure.
than what you say yes to. And most actors are never in a position to be the one who says yes or no. They just throw themselves at everything. And for me, that was my career for more than a decade. I would audition for everything. And the yeses and the nos came from somebody else. Mm-hmm. And mostly it was no. And then every once in a while it was a yes. And you're like, sweet. And you look and you get a paycheck and you pay your bills and you're a working actor, you know, and that's awesome. I was happy doing that. And now, like, by some miracle, I've, you know, and a combination of hard work and good fortune and all these things, like I'm in a position where I'm get to say yes and no, and there's a little responsibility with that. And to make a short answer, it could have been a short answer, a very long answer, you know, help, I have help with those decisions.
But I also think it's great that you've been through stages of your life where, you know, you played character roles and now you can play leading roles, and it's not like you didn't start out as I'm a chiseled six-pack ab kind of, like, because in talking to some, like,
right,
we it seemed like in talking to Harrison Ford there was a little bit of like in between the crankiness it's weird pressure to be a leading man because you feel constrained by those roles, but it seems like, you know, it seems like, well, you could just pick stuff that makes sense, that's kind of fun for you, and you don't have to always do that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, but, you know, but the thing is I did start off in Hollywood. When I came here, one of the first things I did was I got in really good shape, and this is, you know, 13, 14 years ago, and I couldn't audition for anything except for the douche. Like the asshole boyfriend, the Johnny from Karate Kid. My auditions were always like, get in the fucking car, Cheryl. You know what I mean? What's this little twerp doing? Back off, bud. You know, you're in, this is my town, you little, you know, whatever. Yeah. And
next.
Yeah, next. And so I would read those and I was always like, I know, what if he's a little funny? They're like, no, he's not funny. He's the guy that the audience hates. So when the other guy gets the girl, they cheer.
Right.
You know, you're the guy who gets – I was the guy who get kicked in the nuts in the third act. That was – and so for a long time, that's where – what I was doing. And I did some – and I was never very good at it because I – like, it's just not my personality. Like, I was never really comfortable doing that. And as hard as I acted, I just couldn't pull it off to be, like, a major asshole. And so, like, you see evidence of that in some movies. Like, Strangers with Candy was a movie I did years ago where I played Grayson, like, and that's the character, how it was written was like that. My first role in Everwood was written that way, but then they completely crafted the character and changed him and tailored that character to be myself, and then became like a nicer character. The same thing with Andy Dwyer was like, started one way, I was just the asshole boyfriend. And I felt like getting into those roles, unless Andy Dwyer, because I had grown a little bit and was a little out of shape when I started that job, but like those roles were, it took me doing comedic stuff and developing as an actor and get winning people's respect based on being able to actually get laughs and, you know, being able to make moments work in movies, doing that kind of fun stuff that because I had that body of work behind me, I could then get in shape and be considered for these roles. Whereas before, when I got in shape, for some reason, I was only like the asshole, because there is something about a leading man that there's like a sense of, you know, they need to be fallible. They need to be like not quite perfect, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like there's always something a little wrong, I think, like mentally or physically with our heroes, you know, they should be flawed and stuff like that.
Well, and thank God that we have directors like, you know, that the James Gunns and the Joss Whedons and the Sam Raimis of the world who would understand, like, well, the hero actually can be kind of fucked up and funny and doesn't have to be that archetype, you know, that kind of, you know, 50s archetype of what a hero is supposed to be, you know.
Right.
It's like, oh, these guys are sort of fuck ups, and, you know, and but that's that they kind of humanize the leading man sort of a role.
Yeah, I think there's a traditional leading man, and it's actually like a straight man you know, there are confines inside of which you must operate. You can't be, you know, so you, and the spice is left to the side characters, to the villains, to the love interest, to any of the other people, but you kind of just play everything straight. And I think that maybe that's what Harrison was like leaning towards a little bit with what he was saying. You
so
know, like
kind of like the way you are in this movie, which is why I wasn't mentioned in that list. Of yeah.
Well,
names.
We were getting to you. Just,
yeah, that's no, fine. I understand. Like,
I also
I get
thought
it.
That was weird.
Yeah. No. No. It's, I understand. No. I mean, you're, I mean, you're totally straight.
You know, to be fair, I haven't seen Jurassic World yet.
Yeah.
I'm seeing it tonight.
He's basically what you just described.
Well, you know, we'll see when I go.
But no, he's no, no. There, he's not. I'm kidding. He's he's a different kind of hero in this movie. I, you know, I found his character in this movie to be like when we designed it, it was like it was a mixture of like Steven's father and my father because like Steven's father fought in World War II and was like Greatest Generation and like that, you know, that hero that you're talking about. And my dad was in Vietnam and like protested the war in San Francisco and like was, you know, against authority. And so I feel like when you combine those two, you get, you know, someone who does, sort of looks like a traditional hero, but also like is questioning like what the fuck are they doing with, you know, making the dinosaurs. And it's kind of makes him a combination of you know, Jeff Goldblum's character and Sam Neill's character, because those were sort of two sides of that coin, and that's kind of where we ended up.
I think so, and I'm really glad. And I mean, because it is a little different, and which made it so attractive, and part of like the reason, like I said, going back to my manager helping me decide things, we read it. They were like, this is something that's interesting, because we didn't want to just go right out and find a Peter Quill in another role.
Of course.
You know, like, this is just like, just do that. You got that speed. It was like we wanted to do something slightly different. And when Colin painted this picture, because I was like him with being pretty skeptical about going stepping into this franchise because I loved it so much. And when he started talking about the character, I was like, dude, this is so fucking great. He's so different, and something, an opportunity for me to grow, because I feel like as an actor, a lot of times what I do is I fall back on my strength, which is kind of the Andy Dwyer was an embodiment of it, but this sort of witless, you know, witless, guileless, childlike wonder and in tonally comedic type of performance. You know, I tend to put unintentionally put that into every role that I play. And I know it's a big part of my shtick and my own self-defense mechanism. It's like my clown that I've always been working on my whole life. And I think the thing that attracted me so much to this character is Colin was like, this is not Andy. This character's, and that's the third rail for you. I don't want you to be a goofball. I don't want you to be a moron, you know, and you're an expert. It's more important, you know, that it's not, you don't have to be funny.
Yeah.
You have to take this seriously, and people need to count on you to get him out of the situation.
Yeah, I suppose you can't be a dipshit and train raptors.
Yeah, because there's already so much.
Fine.
Yeah, there's already so much disbelief suspended in this movie. You need to make it. You need to approach it with a very, very strong respect for the reality that you're creating.
Sure.
It needs to be real. So, like, if this was a real position, and they had a group of raptors they thought were intelligent enough to be trained, who would get that job? And so we both talked about it and circled around on a guy who, you know, has a history in the military, probably like training marine mammals for combat, has seen his friends die, has seen a lot of his animals die, has been through it, and has worked for an establishment that doesn't care about the animals that he trains and you know, is willing to let them die to advance their research or advance their agenda. And so, like, this is real. It was like, that could be a real person. And he wouldn't be – I mean, I get to have fun with Bryce. I get to tease her. I get to have fun with Hoskins. And I have this sort of, like, smart-ass attitude that is kind of, you know, allows for it to not be a stiff performance or not a stiff character. Like, he has fun. He makes fun of people. Makes fun of his, you know, Claire, his love interest. But when it's all said and done, he takes his job very seriously.
He's also not the guy that, like, the guy that's been presented in the trailers is like, you know, you're going to need my raptors and like all that stuff. Like, that's not a line in the movie. And like, we're going to do this my way, or that whatever they put in the trailer. That,
yeah.
My, that this, you didn't
that's
really
not in
any,
the movie.
You didn't have any input
No, I mean, you know, I do. And yet they still come to me and say like, we need him. If he doesn't say, you know, we're doing this my way or the highway, then no one's going to come see your movie. I'm like, ah, fuck. Okay.
Really? No.
Well, are you sure at all?
We'll never know if they were right.
We'll never know. We'll never ever know. It's absolutely true.
But it is sort of hard when they're like, well, I mean, you know, because I guess it is a small compromise to make. Like, well, fine, you know, at least look, the movie will speak for itself.
It will, and you know, but it is, you know, they very much, you know, the fact that the Raptors, you know, are somewhat, you know, become, I don't want to say militarized, but used to like hunt down this creature. That's not his idea. That's the bad guy's idea.
Sure.
And so, but the idea that it would be his, you know, it paints a totally different picture of a character,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And yet marketing is like, no, we're going to need people to think this is his idea. I'm like, but it's not, that's lying. We're going to need people to go ahead and think that's his idea.
It's too complicated to sell.
Yeah,
idea
exactly.
In 90
yeah.
Seconds.
It's like, it's, but just like throw him on a motorcycle. Like we get it, we're going. And then the odd thing is like, look, when they go see your movie, then they'll realize it doesn't suck.
And yeah. You're still going to get tweets from people that are like, I came to see the movie for the highway. And
he clearly did not do it his way or the highway at all.
There wasn't really like one highway. I mean, I don't understand. You know? What about highway enthusiasts?
It's like when the National Treasure trailer said this dollar bill.
There's dollar bill trying to tell me something. It's not in the movie.
It wasn't in the movie.
Yeah,
but it was in the trailer. It got me to see the movie.
Right. Right. I'm curious to know. You talked about your clown for a second, which is a great way to frame that kind of defensive comedy armor that that comedy people have.
Yeah.
And so
I really borrowed that term from Nick Offerman. Nick Offerman is the one who sort of like helped me.
You need to explore the depths of your clown, Nick Offerman.
Understand the clown.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that kind of your, like, was that persona your Trojan horse into this? Or is it the other way around? It's it feels like, you know, you kind of came here.
It was like a Trojan horse inside of a Trojan horse.
Yeah.
Whoa. Trojan horseception.
Yeah. Like,
Inception 2.
Inception 2. Trojan horses.
The triple Trojan.
We go back to the Trojan Wars.
Wait, what?
What?
In the trailer,
there's three Trojans.
No one's been to the fourth Trojan. Like, getting to the fourth Trojan is like.
It's on an atomic level. If you can split the final Trojan.
I know I'm being you have to go do a bunch of more, a few more interviews, but before you go, just really quickly, like where did that armor come from? What was it about? Because it all goes back to childhood, and so what thing in childhood kind of made you go, oh, I got to armor up, you know?
Laughter, making people laugh, making people feel good, and like as a survival mechanism, you know, deflection, making people laugh was like my way into my brother and all of his friends, my dad, just people in my life.
Is your brother older?
My brother's 3 years older. Was like popular and cool and laughed, loved, and was like, you know, and my sister too. We all laughed our asses off, but it was like that was our currency in our family, in our household, because we didn't have any money, you know, and like we were broke, but we still laughed, you know. We could still, if I could make my dad laugh, then I felt like that was me getting A's, you know what I mean, was getting laughter. And so the clown that I developed was like very straight-faced, dumb guy, asking questions and getting other people, not anyone in my family, because I think they understood that I wasn't an idiot, but maybe my dad didn't, because I think it was like, it was a way that I would actually kind of, it was a way I kind of protected myself and all my siblings probably from my dad a little bit, was I would look him in the eyes and say things that were so completely stupid that it would leave him baffled, and he'd really believe that I thought the things that I was saying, and he would just, it would make him so mad, and it was like taking power, you know, it was taking power away from him. He was like, you know, strong, tough, patriarch type of old school guy.
Would have then yelled to your mother, we got a real idiot over here.
Yeah, he's like, what the?
Lorraine, you have a kid who acts like that. Just bringing it back around. Well, again, that's also congratulations on everything, and you're a super sweet dude, and also your Pledge of Allegiance video. I was like, is he trying to get all of America to fuck him? Because they're just going to put you on the flag at this point.
Yes, like, I'm in.
50 I'm in. Little Pratts.
50 little
just
Pratts.
Little 50.
Great. The Pratts and Stripes.
Yeah, I like it.
But thanks for coming on. I know it's super swamped, and the and they're gracious enough to let me go to the premiere night, so I'm very excited.
Are you going?
To
see
yeah,
cool,
I'm going.
That'll
so
be
I'm,
awesome.
I'm excited to. Cool. I'm so excited to see.
Everyone,
the movie.
Go see this movie in 3D. It's a good conversion. That's what Colin told me.
Yeah, that's the sale. Yeah, it's a good conversion. It sounds
he
like
says
it's such a mathematical.
Colin said it was his conversion way or the highway.
I'm just saying, if you're in your town, you have an option. See it in 3D.
Go see a conversion.
Go see a good.
That's
exciting.
Kids love conversions.
This is the truth. This is the truth. What the first movie did was made computer generated, you know, animation look better than it's ever had before. Like it looked kind of bad before, or it was stop motion. Like the dinosaurs looked amazing, and that was the reason. That was something that we saw. We saw these dinosaurs birthed essentially on screen, and that was really captivating. And I think this movie does something with making these dinosaurs look so real, and especially in 3D, that you kind of look, you'll be able to watch. It's going to be one of those movies that when it comes on, you're not going to be able to turn it off forever, and it's going to be on whatever platforms, TV, cable, you know.
Oh, it's one of these movies I'm flipping through. It's on
yeah,
Spike.
It's on. You're gonna stop and watch it, but you're not going to get to watch it in the type of 3D that is the very best 3D, and that's IMAX, and that's like in your movie theater. And I think you're always going to love it, but you'll kind of be missing out if you don't see it in 3D, I think.
I felt it. I saw it last night at the IMAX Chinese theater here, which is the best movie projection, the best presentation of a movie I've ever seen in my life. This new laser projection they have, it's insane. And I went and saw it last night with the crew. We had a crew screening, and even I'm pretty familiar with the movie. You know, have these moments where I'm like, shit, this is awesome. You know, and like you know, when he's riding on the motorcycle with the rad, there's just like these moments of like exhilarating childlike. This is rad. This is awesome. And that to be able to even provide a couple of those moments is very thrilling for
well,
us.
Well, also very inspirational, and having read some stuff about you and I know you'd auditioned for other big movies and then just felt like, oh, I don't have it. I don't have that thing that you're supposed to have. I think you're a testament to like, well, you don't always know that, you know, and if you just keep work hard and keep your head down, be nice to people and stay focused, you know, you'll figure it out.
Oh, thanks, man.
So thank you for being here, and congratulations, Colin.
Thanks, man.
And I'll see you guys tonight, probably,
yeah.
I guess.
Let's get dressed
well,
up.
Well, maybe not literally. It'd probably be pretty
crazy.
Who
see you or Peter?
Oh my God, you gained 40 pounds today?
Yeah, I did it. I did it for 12 years. I feel like I proved it.
Wow. Oh God.
Enjoy your burrito.
All right, thanks.
See you guys.
Thank you. Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome that dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric, and this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!